You're listening to Showtime
on URN.
Hello, I'm Ella Vidrinska from Showtime, URN's specialist musical theatre show, and you're listening to our podcast Spotlight On, where I'm keeping you up to date each week with all the latest theatrical news. And as you'll have seen from the image for this podcast, this week's episode is all about the musical Waitress. Now, this is an amazing show by Sarah Bareilles, and it's on its way to Nottingham right now. It'll be here at the Royal Concert Hall from Monday the 18th of July to Saturday the 23rd of July, and you can get your tickets via the link here in the post. But what makes it all the more exciting is that I had the chance to chat to David Hunter, who plays Dr. Pometer in the show. That's the romantic lead. He is the gynecologist who the lead character Jenna ends up falling for when she becomes pregnant and they start a whirlwind affair. I mean, it's a tale as old as time. But David Hunter is an incredible performer who I personally have been aware of for years, back from when he was on ITV Superstar, which was one of those Andrew Lloyd Webber-led talent shows to find someone to play Jesus in the arena tour of Jesus Christ Superstar. In fact, if you're interested in hearing more about the experience of being on that show, then David actually has just launched a brand new podcast called Jesus Christ Supercast with his friend Tim Protty Jones, who was also on the show. I will link to that in the post too, because it sounds great, like so up my street, so I would definitely recommend. But as with a lot of these musical theatre talent TV shows, so many amazing performers have come out of it. And David Hunter is one whose career has just gone from strength to strength to strength. He's had leading roles in shows like Once and Kinky Boots and now Waitress, of course. In fact, not only is he in the current tour of the show, he also originated the role of Dr. Pometer in the West End. And he started off by telling me how he first got involved in the show.
So it was as always just another audition, but quite a special one in that sort of months and months, maybe a year before it was coming over, people had started saying to me, "Oh, there's a part for you in Waitress that you'd be really good for." And actually, I hate that because it heaps a load of pressure on me. You go, "Oh no, there's a role that I would probably do quite well in terms of, at the very least, I'll get to sort of the final stages of auditions." And all that really means is that you're investing in that process in a way that, again, even though I was perfect for it, I could easily not have got it. The people I was up against were just as perfect for it in their own ways, you know. And so wrongly, when a show comes over that there isn't a part for me, and like Dear Evan Hansen came over and was like, "I'm too young for the dads and I'm too old for Evan. Great, I'm out. I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to stress and panic." But really, let's be honest, I should be wishing for roles to come that I can play, as opposed to just wishing I could sit on the sofa and maybe someone will ring me up one day and say, do you want a job? But yeah, Waitress came over and was coming over, and there was a role in it that was perfect for me. And so I started the process, and it was a stressful, horrible, wonderful process. You know, I met Lucy Jones through the process at one of the auditions, and we very quickly got paired up in the finals, and it was kind of me and her singing together a lot, and Sarah Bareilles was there and she sang around the piano with us, and we went through some songs and stuff. And then there was a long old wait, and then I got the gig, but not before. There was two of us in the finals for the part, and we knew it was like, it's me or you, isn't it? That's how it's going to work. And we were in touch because it took months to get a decision, and we didn't know why. So we were in touch with each other, as much as I hated that, because it was stressful. And he messaged me one day and said, "I guess you got the part, mate. I've just found out I haven't got it. Congratulations." And I hadn't heard anything. And I was like, and my heart sank. I was like, "Oh," and I said, "Mate, I haven't heard. So I haven't got it." And he said, "Oh, maybe they gave it to an American or something. They're going to fly someone over, the original guy or something." So I rang my agent. She rang up the casting director, David Grimrod, about to let loose. She's about to, because she's always defending my corner. She's going to go, "This is disgusting. Why is he finding out from someone else that he's not got the part?" And she phoned up ready to give him both barrels. And he goes, "Hi, Carolyn. Yes, I'm about to get in touch. Don't worry. He's got an offer. I'm just waiting for the contract to come through." And so she called me back and said, "Dave, they have gone with someone else. And it's you."
And no, that's horrible.
Yeah, she gave me a best Simon Cowell.
Yeah,
exactly that, yeah. But then beyond then, I don't want to waffle on about it too long, but from that moment, the whole process, every cast we've had, it's been the most fun and the most enjoyable part I've ever played. It's just on stage and off, it's just gorgeous. I love it. And so when the opportunity was to come back, I jumped at it.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, you mentioned that, like, you love the idea of just being able to sit on the sofa and wait for someone to call and offer you a part. But, like, with Waitress, you were in the show in London, then yeah. you were out the show for a bit, then you were back in it. Then a pandemic started and the show closed and you sort of, you know, you hung up your stethoscope and I presumably kind of like got ready to move on with your life.
Yeah.
And then the phone call came saying, David, we need you back for the tour. We're getting the band back together. Like, what was your reaction to that?
I was thrilled to bits. I really was. It was because they'd spoken to me about it, not in any real terms, but way back when they said, would you be up for doing a tour if we wanted you? And I was like, I can't, not for a year. I've got two young kids at home. At the time they were 1 and 3. Now they're 6 and 4. So it kind of feels slightly different. And this is I'm only doing a 3-month stint. So I felt it was manageable, but no, I was elated. Just to the idea of being able to go back and do it again. I'd always hoped, without wishing anyone, you know, ill, that there might be a crisis with COVID and they'd have to swing me in for just a few shows just to kind of relive it and experience that again. Because coming back to it, honestly, it's magical. And it's the same, you know, predominantly the same set and props and doctor's table. So when I put my hands on those things, it's exactly the same as it was way back when. And it's a weird sort of, feels like an odd dream. I see the ghosts of all the different people, not that they died, they passed on, but like all the different cast members are there, you know. Yeah, it was brilliant. And also, it was weird. There was a weird day because I'd written a musical in lockdown, like a full musical, and it was going to go on at the Arts Theatre in Leicester Square in London. And the day that I got the call about Waitress, it had been cancelled because two of the investors had gone bust and we'd lost like £200,000, basically. They'd gone bust and Waitress called an hour later and said, is he free? And I wouldn't have been free if I was doing this musical. So it felt like a kind of fate thing. I'm not a big fate believer, to be honest, but in that moment I was like, well, this is weird that this happened on the same day, you know? I was just kind of really keen to do it from that moment on.
What is it though that makes this show so special for you and that makes the character of Dr. Parmiter so special specifically?
It's because I get lots of time backstage to drink tea.
That's fair, yeah.
It's just a perfect balance. I go on, funny scene, great song, cup of tea. Funny scene, great song, cup of tea, biscuit, you know? So like, it's a lovely balance. I get loads of really enjoyable, fun stuff to do on stage. The songs are gorgeous. I've always said that the score is the real star of this show, you know, whoever the cast is. It's just so good. And I loved it way before I auditioned for it, which isn't often the case for me. I don't listen to a lot of musical theatre soundtracks relentlessly, but this one, start to finish, love it. So I get loads of fun on stage, sing these great songs, and then I get enough time off stage just to, there's not a lot of pressure on my voice, there's not a lot of pressure on my body. I can just, unlike other shows I've done where it's like I was close to like keeling over, you know, and losing loads of weight and feeling ill and worried and stressed and all those things. This is a relative breeze, you know, and I can just enjoy it. And again, sorry to waffle, but
no,
when I'm enjoying it, it works. So I can come on with a glint in my eye and I can try and have fun with whoever's playing Jenna and try and, you know, tease and tickle her in that way that night to make it kind of fun and alive, and I love it. It's great.
I mean, the word I'm going to pick you up on there is fun, because everything that I know about you and that I've seen from you before is this like kind of epitome of silliness, if I can call it that.
Yeah.
And you know, the image that comes to mind in particular is when you're doing West End karaoke and you came on dressed as Jenna to sing a parody of She Used to Be Mine, and like. It feels like a weird question to ask, but does it make the show more special? And whether that's Waitress, whether that's anything you're doing, but to be able to have the freedom to bring that kind of fun and silliness and humour to it, both on stage and off, is that something that's important to you?
Yeah, it is 100%. And I think and like you say, I think Waitress has epitomised that. It allows me the freedom, and the people who make it have allowed me the freedom within boundaries. And I'm not someone to go wildly off script or anything, but it's just that they allow me to play and find things. And you know, the stuff that's just become well, you know, in amongst its fans of Waitress who've seen it from the beginning, sort of like line readings that have become really like iconic to them of like, oh, that's how it is. That's, but it's so silly. Like, it's just, I think Dr. Pomatis just allows you moments of silliness buried underneath his kind of, in his, in this moment of meeting Jenna where he kind of very quickly falls in love or fancies her very quickly and is trying to be cool and can't manage it. And his bumbling nature comes out and he makes bad decisions. And I love that where there's, you know, sometimes there's lines that I'll just suddenly sing just to be like, he decides that's the way he should deal with that awkward moment. And it just crashes and burns. And that is just my, I suppose that what I'm saying is that Dr. Pomatis is my goofiest self brought to the fore. Because there's nothing that he does that I don't completely understand where I go, yeah, I've been there. I've made a fool of myself in that way, you know. But yeah, the glint in the eye is what I want every show, just to, you know, be like, what's going to happen next? This is fun, you know.
Have you ever gone slightly too far and either broken yourself and started laughing or managed to get someone else on stage to corpse?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, Lucy Jones is like the worst corpse in the world. You'll laugh at anything. Chelsea Halfpenny, who's playing Janet at the minute, is she's on the edge of laughing a few times. We had a little laugh yesterday. What did we do yesterday? There's certainly something that set us off. I picked up, there's a bit where the note goes flying in the air and he has to catch it. And obviously that's different every night because I can't predict how paper's going to fall or fly. And it just landed by her feet. So as I picked it up, I like pretended to tickle her feet, you know, in a bad decision that he makes.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous. And we just started like, we just kind of looking at each other's foreheads. That's when, you know, when actors are trying not to corpse, you kind of go, are they looking at each other's foreheads? Just at each other's hairlines.
Tricks of the trade there, don't reveal too much. But you've done this show long enough now that you've obviously played Dr. Pomatis against a variety of different people playing Jenna, you know, Kat McPhee and Lucy Jones, Chelsea Halfpenny, Olivia Moore as well, like so many people. Yeah. Do you find as an actor there is a marked difference about how you play Dr. Pomatis against their versions of Jenna? Like, even though the source material is exactly the same, do you find that things change?
Yeah, they do. I don't feel like you'd spot it from off stage, if you know what I mean, but it's just finding your groove. A lot of people over the years I've been doing it have talked about like the chemistry I've had with Kat or Lucy or Chelsea or whatever it is. And I always think that boils down to two actors who are just really watching and listening to each other. So if ever I'm a bit lost, if ever I'm not quite sure what I'm doing on stage in terms of like, oh, I don't feel quite in it, or I'm just not feeling it tonight in the same way, I just lock into my scene partner, whoever that is, and just lock in with them and just see what are we doing, and just look in their eyes and just feel like what they're feeling and what they're thinking and what they're giving me, and not getting too wrapped up in myself. Do you know what I mean? Just going, okay, let's get back to what is the scene about and how do we do it? And that obviously remains consistent, but they're such different performers, all of them. Yeah. So different, but all so skilled. We've never had a Jenna who isn't just like really fantastic, you know.
I mean, there's still the chance for you to play Jenna, you know, if you wanted to go down that route.
Hanging around, I keep saying I'm available, but they're very close-minded about the sort of person who should play Jenna, not me apparently.
Do you think there would be like a sort of, you know, final show fun day where for like one scene you're allowed to go on stage?
I'd love it. Do you know what I wanted to, because we often, you know, muck up matinees are the thing, aren't they, like on that last day people start to play around. I really wanted on Lucy Jones's last matinee to show up, where I think they were in like Edinburgh or somewhere, so it would have been very tricky, but just walk into the first scene without knowing I was going to be there, just walk in and then go, oh sorry, wrong room, walk out, and then let Matt Willis walk in and do the scene. There's plenty of fun to be had, isn't there?
Oh, that's mad. No, but I mean, I think this is the thing with Waitress, and it seems like it's given you kind of a really good platform to sort of embrace kind of who you want to be as a character, but also as an actor and as a performer. Mm. Are there any, and I realize you must get asked this all the time, but are there any like dream roles that you're still like, that's something that off the back of this, I think I really want to do that?
And no, there isn't at all. And it hasn't been for a long time. My dream role, I think, was Guy in Once. And I did it. That was when we were doing Superstar 10 years ago. Me and Tim Pratt-Jones were sat in our room that we shared together in our little single beds, and I was looking at the Once Broadway website and saying, this is the show I want to do. Like, this is it for me. I get to play guitar. I get to sing these songs I'd love for from the film for like almost a decade at that point. I feel very fortunate that it was made into a musical at a point where I was about the right age to play it, you know, and I could do it and had just done the show and I met the casting director for Once on Superstar, doing Superstar. He was the casting director there as well. Before that, I'd never been seen by him, and I kind of believe I wouldn't have been seen for Once if I'd not done Superstar. I feel very lucky that I got to do it. And even then, being as perfect for it as I was, because there was not many people who could play it and sing it and do the accent and act it like that, you know, it's a very kind of specific sort of piece. Even then, I had to really scrap to get the role. Like, they didn't want to give it to me. They thought I was too young. And then they wanted to get a celebrity. And they, you know, and I just had to kind of stick in there, and I had to play really hardball with them. It's a unique time in my life where they needed me a bit more than I needed them. They wanted to stay on and cover it. And I was like, I'll do it, but only if I can take over for a stint, you know, and eventually it all fell into place. But yeah, that was the dream. But since then, there hasn't been a dream. You know, I wanted to play a leading role in a West End show, and I did that, and I did it with my dream show. So since then, it's just been whatever jumps up. You know, and I've loved that show. I think really, if I'd known what Waitress could have been, that probably would have been my dream, but I didn't until I was in it, you know. So no major dreams really, which is kind of a scary feeling in a lot of ways, because I've no idea what I'm pointed at. I'm just kind of like following my nose, you know.
But I think that's also quite a refreshing way of looking at it, because, you know, if I feel like from talking to other people who work in this industry, it can end up being something where you put all of your hopes onto one intangible thing, and then if it doesn't happen, you know, you could have the most esteemed career ever, and then if that one thing doesn't happen, then you feel like, oh god, I'm a failure, and we're all our own worst critics.
Oh, aren't we? So, just
I think that's probably quite a refreshing way of looking, being like, hey, I've done the thing that was like the bucket list, and now I'm just enjoying myself, which is really lovely.
Yeah, it's lovely. And I think people can fall into that trap, like you say, of never quite feeling fulfilled because they didn't get to that, you know, magic golden thing that they wanted. And the reality is, as someone who did get to that magic golden thing, it just becomes another thing that you did. It isn't the, you know, life altering thing you think it's going to be. You know, it doesn't make you happier. It kind of fills that hole and goes, great, that's done. And that's it. That really is it. And then other than that, it's work. You've got to work hard, and there's a pressure that comes with that, and there's the stress that comes with that. And there's joy. There's loads of joy with that as well. But then it ends, and then it's like, okay, what's next? You know, and it just keeps rolling, doesn't it? But yeah, certainly I feel very lucky to have kind of got to where I wanted to be and realized that it doesn't change your whole life. Like, I'm not rich and famous, am I? Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm just saying, you know, going to another audition like I did with Waitress, come and prove yourself again. Maybe doing that forever.
I mean, that's the actor's life, isn't it? People think that it's all this, you know, high glamour, and it's so it very ain't. Quickly dissuaded of that. Yeah. But, you know, you I mean, we have to mention it. You talked about Superstar just then. I mean, that's how I think a lot of us know you, where you sort of first came to sort of stardom, if you want to call it that. I mean, what was that experience like, being involved in that show?
It was wholly positive, really. You know, as you mentioned, we've just done a podcast. We've just been rewatching all the episodes because it's exactly 10 years that it was aired on July the 7th. It was 10 years ago, exactly. So me and my mate, Tim Prattie-Jones, who were there together, have been rewatching all the episodes and talking about them and reminiscing and kind of watching it slightly less emotionally and going, okay, how did I do, really? You know, and how do I feel about it now, 10 years more experienced and 10 years better, you hope? It was a great experience. We were treated really nicely on the whole and with respect, because by this point, Andrew Lloyd Webber had done four other talent shows for Joseph and Dorothy and Maria and the like. And so it was attracting really good people. Like, we got to kind of the final 40 and we were looking around and seeing West End stars. In fact, I saw the guy who I'd recently missed out on a role to him after 9 auditions. He'd got the role and he was still doing that role when we were auditioning for Superstar. And I was like, what are you doing here?
Oh my God.
I'm here because I didn't get the role you got. You can leave. but yeah, everyone knew. It was like, this is a great opportunity. And I was constantly missing out to people who'd been on the Joseph program and done really well on that.
Yeah.
And it was like, well, do we go with Dave or this guy who was on that program? And they went with him every time. And I just felt like I need to push myself into another bracket. And I think Superstar did that. It's hard to kind of, people often like ask, like, do you think it changed it for you? And I'm still not really sure. I think it gave me more opportunities, gave me a bit more of people knowing who I was when I went into auditions, and gave me a bit of a reputation for something, whatever that was, good or bad. But certainly with the big shows that came into town, like Once, Kinky Boots, Waitress, I don't feel like it was like, oh, great, give it to Dave. It was still like I got in the room in a way that I might have not done before. But then it was like, right, prove yourself. Are you right for this exact role? And that's all it is. You know, I don't feel like anything was handed to me beyond that, other than just a bit more time maybe in the room, a bit more kindness. I wasn't kind of waiting around quite so long. Oh, I didn't feel like just another face in the crowd. I felt like people were excited to see me when I came into an audition, you know, in a way that they weren't before, you know, as a complete unknown. So it shifted it in that way. But yeah, it was a great experience, and we were treated really nice. It wasn't that sort of reality TV show nonsense of kind of like pulling out sob stories. In fact, the thing that stood out to me watching the podcast is I never speak on the program. I'm like a mute. It's like the story is this man can't speak, but he can sing. Do you know what I mean?
Honestly, I mean, there's a musical in that for sure.
bank it now. Ella, we're on to something.
No, but I think, I mean, I say this as a long time musicals fan. I really enjoy those shows because I think it's such a good way of platforming musical theatre and in mainstream TV, but also platforming those performers. And when I look at the current industry and the people that I most admire and most respect, and I'm like, oh, if I see that that person is in something, I'm really excited. So many of them came from these shows, and it's you know, watching someone like Jessie Buckley win the Olivier for Cabaret in the same year that she got nominated for an Oscar, being like, you tried to be Nancy. Like, it's amazing. And also, I remember, this is absolutely by the by, but I was rewatching a clip of Superstar a couple of years ago. I think it must have been during lockdown. And I realized that Ross William Wilde had auditioned for it. And like, I knew him from Million Dollar Quartet, and then obviously went off and did Spandau Ballet. Yeah. And I absolutely lost my mind, because the reason he didn't get through to the final was because Andrew Lloyd Webber said that he seemed too vain. Yeah. And I'm like, what absolute shade from Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Yeah, he was a big sort of, he got a knock on that, didn't he? Because it's funny, we always were saying through the process, if I don't get through, it's fine. None of us had any high expectation, because we knew it was kind of so much to do with personality you don't know how stiff the competition is or whatever. But if I do get sent home, I hope they don't film me at any point. Like, you know, I hope I don't get featured at all. And there was hundreds of guys who came, auditioned, went home, fine, you know. But Ross and Sam Cassidy was another one who got featured very heavily, and then were very, you know, very publicly told, we just think you're, you know, a bit vain, so all the best. And they get loads of coverage, and it's like, oh, that's not the narrative you want to leave with. You know, just let me go home. Just let me sleek off into the shadows, you know. But yeah, he got a bit of a beating at that point, didn't he?
Yeah. What was your favourite bit of feedback that you got as a contestant?
There was loads, and it's funny. I was talking about this the other day on the podcast, that when you see people doing things that you like, you must tell them. Because I think people often assume that you already know. Like, if I see someone do a great performance, oh wow, they're brilliant, they don't need me to tell them, you know, how dare I tell them, it seemed patronizing, you know. But actually, there's things that like Mel C, former Spice Girl, said to me that have become like pillars of my like self-belief, you know, where it's like, oh I do that, like, you know, she said, oh, you've got a really unique voice, we haven't heard a voice like yours in the competition. I was like, oh really? I had no idea that was how people saw it. And Dawn French was like, oh, you're the actor in the competition. Oh, okay. I just assumed everyone was doing what I was doing. And actually, we were all doing different things. And my, you know, so again, all these things that I've learned about myself, where it's like my focus is always on the acting first and the voice second. Obviously, I try to hope they both do their job. But, you know, I always think you learn the song, you learn it backwards, so it just flies out your mouth, and then you just act. You know, that's what you're focusing on. And I don't think that's how everyone saw it. A lot of them were trying to just sing, you know. And it was just these things that people say to you. And then there was a day that I just sang Apologize. It was like the final seven or something. And Andrew kind of made this speech about what a good actor I was and how I make anyone in the audience feel special. And it stuck with me my whole life, you know. It's like, wow, okay, that's what I do. Someone that I respect has told me I do this thing, and I believe it now wholeheartedly. And we were talking the other day about how, you know, negative things can stick with you in the same way. And that's why we've got to be so careful with what we say to people and giving feedback and, you know, looking, because rightly or wrongly, I mean, the truth is Andrew could have been entirely wrong about that. And I could be absolutely useless at this, but I've held it dear this whole time. Someone could be wrong saying, I think he's a terrible singer. And that could stick with me for the rest of my life, long after that person's got on with theirs and completely forgotten about me, you know. Mm. I just think it's important in the Twitter age that we live in, that we just kind of think, this thing you're saying, it will hurt people, even if you feel like they're beyond your reach. We speak in the podcast, and I won't go on about it. We speak in the podcast, Tim received a tweet after the first show that was like, I don't like Tim Pretty Jones. And it sent into us into a spiral of like panic attacks for the next 24 hours while he was doing this live show. That person will have no idea they even sent that tweet. They won't have the faintest memory of it. And yet to Tim, it stuck with him and has stuck with him for 10 years. And I just think that's just the power of those words is astonishing, isn't it? And how it's so flippant to the person sending it and so important to the person who receives it. I just think, was your opinion that vital in that moment? You've hurt that, you've changed this man's life with that tweet, you know? And so when we hear about people, this is not Tim, but like the people who get into real, you know, celebrities who find themselves in a real depressing slump. I understand it when I see people, like, you don't know how robust they are when you send them that tweet, or how weak they're feeling in that moment, you know. Anyway, I don't mean to go on about it.
I was going to say, lift the spirits. But has it been weirdly cathartic watching it all back? Like, had you seen it prior to recording the podcast in full?
No, I hadn't. I'd seen bits. I always revisited bits because it was such an amazing memory to have, and it was so intense and exciting, and you know, it felt like a real change, a chapter change in our lives. You know, no, it is amazing to watch back. I think the thing I think about when I'm watching it back is like, that guy that I'm watching did have all those dreams that he was striving for and hadn't achieved any of them. And I, you know, without sounding too corny, if he could see what we then achieved in the following 10 years, he'd fall over. It was everything that he dreamed of, you know, everything. And really specifically, like literally sat in that room gazing at once Broadway musical website and dreaming of it. It happens. And then there's other shows, and there's more things, and there's music, and there's podcasts. You know, it's amazing to watch that guy and see him nervously trying to take his first steps into those dreams, and just amazing that it's like, you did it. You know, very proud of him.
Oh, bless. That's such a lovely way of looking at it. Because, I mean, you do seem to have such, you know, a vast array of side projects going on at the moment. And like you mentioned music there. And I mean, I will say Farm Song, absolute banger. Thank you very much for that. Did you ever think that, like, you know, what was the goal to try and do musical theatre and have this kind of like singing career alongside it? Or did you think that you were going to go down one route or the other?
I always think acting was always it, you know, musicals or plays or TV or whatever. Like, acting is absolutely it. Music is a real passion. I love writing music. Music's been my therapy, you know, as a songwriter since I was an angsty teenager and falling in love with people who were out of my league, you know. And that's why I started writing songs. And so I just love writing songs. Now, so when I release stuff, it's not with any aspiration to, you know, get into the charts or become a touring pop star or anything like that. It's literally because I love writing. I love recording. I love releasing and people listening to it. I wish the more people would listen to it. I wish, you know, whilst I'm not aspiring to take it anywhere, I would love everyone to hear it and enjoy it, because that's part of the fun as well. But no, I mean, fundamentally at my heart, I just love making stuff. I just want to make stuff forever. So whether it's podcasts or music, I love designing stuff. I love the imagery of it. I love painting and writing and making. And I've written this musical and I've made this podcast and all these things. I just want to make stuff. I want to write a book. You know, I want to just make it. And that's where the joy comes from. I suppose the pressure of that is like, oh, it needs to, like, I've announced this podcast today. And it's like, how do I persuade people to be interested in this? Because at the surface, it's very niche. There was a program on 10 years ago. and now we're going to talk about it, you know? So people will be thinking, well, I didn't watch the program, so I'm not going to listen to the podcast. But in essence, we then talk about a load of nonsense, you know, worst dance calls ever and, you know, fun stuff like that. And it's a lot of fun, but yeah. And so obviously I feel like at some point I'm going to stumble across the creative thing I want to do, which is also appeals to a really broad audience that might become something that's really successful. And that, which again, isn't the point, but it would be really fun to kind of like, if I came up with a podcast idea that's like, oh, this is much less niche. I've got good at doing it because of the supercast. Mm-hmm. And now I can like unleash those new skills onto the world. But yeah, I just want to do it. I just want to enjoy making stuff. And like I say, I wrote this musical. I've never written a musical before. I sat down at my computer and I was saying, right, I tried to do it with a few people and I said, just do it. Just write on your own. So, okay. So I've written all the songs or a load of the songs and I just sat down. And I won't swear, but I put Stuck, because that was called Stuck by David Effing Hunter. And I was like, just do it, Dave. Just do it. Don't worry about it being right or wrong or what are the rules of writing. I don't know. I just wrote it. I wrote it all in capital letters. I didn't take a breath. I just wrote it in like a few days. And it's great. It's really fun. It's a really good, fun thing. Part of me is a bit like, I almost never want to show it to anyone. I'm almost glad it didn't happen at the arts, because then people would like critique it and tell, you know, and I get enough of that with the job I do. It's like, this is supposed to be just fun. Like, even again with my music, I was going to call my first EP Not For Review, because it was like, I don't want you to review it. Please don't review this thing, because it's mine. I want it to be precious and loved. And if you love the farm song, you know, if it's a bopper for you, great. Critically, it's not a masterpiece. I know it's not. It's a great, fun song, and I want people to enjoy it. So if you want it, enjoy it. If you don't want it, go away. I don't want to hear your opinion on my, you know, this thing that came from my soul. So it's a funny thing, you know. But yeah, fundamentally, I just love making stuff, and I know long after anyone cares about what I do or any, you know, putting on gigs and no one will come because I'm a bit old and saggy and no one cares anymore. I'll still be writing songs. I'll still be in my back room writing the most important song I think I've ever written and paying my mate £300 to record it for me so I can just be like, I made this thing, you know. Yeah, and I just have to come to terms with the fact that no one cares anymore. So that'll be a tricky transition, Ella, and I hope you'll support me through it.
I mean, of course. I mean, while we're on the topic of making things, I have to genuinely say thank you for the Space Between.
Space Between.
Because my God, that remains one of my favorite things that came out of lockdown. And, you know, it feels odd to say that like there was a benefit of lockdown, but the way that theatre changed and adapted and sort of embraced these new creative ideas.
Yeah.
And I think the Space Between is such a good example of that. You know, it's this like little 15 minute show. You can watch it over a cup of tea. It doesn't, you know, you don't have to give up your entire evening to it. And it's so gorgeous. Like, you talk about not having things, not necessarily being a masterpiece. There's a lyric in The Space Between that I think about constantly. And it's that bit in On Your Side. I know I'm just waxing lyrical now. But
No, I'm loving this. It's great. It's lovely.
The lyric in On Your Side where Caroline says, you make everything better. And you reply, but I can't make everything right. Yeah, God, like straight into the heart. That, like, I genuinely think it's one of my favorite lyrics in all of musical theatre. So,
but Ella, well, thank you, because it's like I say, we put these things into the world. And again, that was me and Caroline. We still haven't met properly. We've only met for 2 minutes.
Have you really not?
No, we never met properly. We've never had a cup of tea, you know.
Well, that's gonna have to be the callback in Waitress. She's gonna have to walk onto a scene, say, "Oh, sorry, wrong room," and then leave. I mean, put it out there into the world.
Well, we need to do it. We keep talking about it, but we both end up being so busy, because there's actually there's a kind of a plot outline in my mind for A Space Between Two, which what would happen next after the pandemic sort of thing, and how they next come into contact with each other. But yeah, that was just another thing that we kind of made and passionately, and we, you know, the voice notes back and forth to me and Caroline, so full of passion, you know, of like what we're going to do and how we're going to make it and how we're going to record it and how do we get past these technical elements that we've no idea what we're going to do, and we just made it. And I forever feel like it should have been like more appreciated. Do you know what I mean? I feel like, oh, this should have just been this huge, because it was so good, like, you know, in so many ways. I can say that because someone else made a lot of it, so I can go, oh yeah, she's amazing. I'm not saying about me, she's amazing. But to hear, you know, to hear someone like yourself talk about it really specifically, like there's this lyric, because we pored over every syllable. It was important. And yet you can sit with it for 15 minutes, it can breeze past your ears and you can never engage with it again. And I'm sure a lot of people did that. Or it can knock you in the heart a little bit and suddenly you remember a lyric or you feel a moment or you engage with it to in another level. So to hear you talk about it in that way, it honestly means like it's the whole reason for doing it. And, you know, other than the joy of just making it. But like I say, to have an audience to hear someone say like that meant something in that moment to me. I was like, isn't that amazing? And we just made it ourselves in our back rooms. It's so cool. I love that.
Do you find that, because like from my perspective, talking to you, and I'm this huge fan, and it feels like on social media and whenever you're announcing a project, it feels like you've got this army of diehard fans. And do you find like, is it kind of more special that you have these people who follow your work and who seemingly would like go to the ends of the earth to see you perform?
Yeah.
Even if it's not necessarily like what you might call a more mainstream audience in heavily inverted commas.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Fact of the matter is, without that, you know, small group of people, you know, in the grand scheme of things, I couldn't do any of this stuff. So like I say, I'll always write songs and whatever it is, but they lead to the end thing of like, and now I can show people, and I might get comments like yours or tweets or whatever it is that go, wow, they loved it, you know, and they're taking it into their hearts. And, you know, I know the songs that I've released that a very small group of people will carry with them for the rest of their lives. Like I do with the music of Howard New, who you've never heard of, and Air Traffic, who you've probably never heard of, and Danny Kerwin, who you've definitely never heard of. And all these people, their music will be with me for the rest of my life. Mm. And if I get to be that for, you know, if you're listening to The Space Between in another 10 years time, because it just happens to, you know, come on a shuffle in your brand new iPhone 28, whatever it is, then you know, how magic, you know, yeah. that exists in someone's heart somewhere. But funny enough, equally, when I do release these things, it doesn't feel like they just get swept away. I feel like I have to, it's like I've announced this podcast, as I say, feels very niche. That, you know, the cover is like a parody of the old Jesus Christ Superstar album, but people won't know that because they're, you know, not everyone's engaged with that. So, okay, how do I now, I've got a week until it's released, how do I persuade these people that under the surface of the nicheness of it, there's a very listenable thing that you can just enjoy as anyone? I'll fill you in on what's happening in the show. Don't worry about that. It's actually just about two actors who are coming from, a place of very little experience navigating this bizarre thing. And I'm still working out how to do that myself, but it certainly doesn't feel like this army of fans grab it and go, yes, we will make you popular. It feels very much like I'm going to go, right, let's start peddling and see if I can persuade them to come to the gig, watch Space Between, listen to the podcast, you know. Then occasionally you get things like, I'm now in Waitress the Musical, and they go nuts, and that's easy. You know, you go, ah, great. I don't have to work. I can just go, I can put anything out. I could put just a little mound of flour out, and they'd be like, ah, yes, come on, waitress. You know, and then so you need one of those now and again just to be like, ah, it's so nice not to work.
Yeah. Do you feel like it's a balancing act, though? Because I feel like with musical theatre as a kind of an industry and as a genre, if you want to call it that, like it so often feels like we're trying to fight this uphill battle of, you know, oh, we're not niche, we're not this old fashioned stereotype of like jazz hands and high kicks, and you know, we're not elitist, while at the same time trying to put stuff out there that can be a bit niche or a bit weird a bit off the wall, and trying to find the. I was talking the other week to Stuart Brayson, the composer from Here to Eternity, and he was saying, like, it's this, you know, really difficult line to toe where you want something that is new and fresh and original but is also commercially viable. And so like from your perspective as a performer and a creative within this industry, how do you go about finding that balance?
It is tricky, isn't it? And I think you're right. Musical theatre is seen as a very specific thing. And I mean, I get very irritated I kind of get irritated when people say, I don't like musical theatre. It's like, well, what type of musical theatre? Because we can't say Mamma Mia and Once are the same thing. They're not. They're vastly different things. And most musicals are very different things, you know. And again, like you say, Once kind of suffered from the fact that, in essence, it was a very small, gentle, intimate musical that we're trying to make commercially viable in a big theatre, and that it kind of plays against it. And so that's always a And again, you know, with the musical I've written, it's designed for a small space, really, you know, but obviously anyone who gets involved wants to put it in a bigger and bigger and bigger room. But it's like, I know it would probably be at its best in a smaller room, you know, in a very intimate space. So you can see it all. It can be a real story in a kind of weird setting. But I think there's nothing better than acting through song. It's just a glorious thing. I know from going into auditions, you know, it's like, right, give us a few pages of the script or whatever it is, and you read it, and however good it is, however emotional those scenes might be, and they're often very not, they're just a silly, fun little scene or whatever it might be. And they go, yeah, great, thank you. And you've done your scene. Mm. And then you sing a song, and the intro comes in, and there's a beautiful piano line, and they're feeling something before you've even opened your mouth. And all you have to do is like jump on that wave and go with it. And if you can just kind of let that music kind of flow through you and out your gob, then you've got this, you can make them feel something in the 2 minutes you're singing in front of them. You've just done two pages of script and they're like, yeah, great, he can act, great, fantastic. Then you do a song and they can be tearing up, or they can be laughing, or whatever it is. And you know, you can finish a song and it's just a dead silence. They're like, whoa, something just happened in this room. There's a thing, a spark just happened. It's a magical thing. So, you know, I think it's I think musical theatre is a joyous thing. And I say that as not as a massive musical theatre fan. I don't watch loads of musicals. I'm not a big musical theatre geek in any way. I don't like, you know, but I know the feeling of sitting in the audience and someone connecting to a song and singing it, and you just going, and it feels like the whole world just shrinks around them and everything's fuzzy and they're just there. You're just there with them and they're singing this song. And you're like, I'm in it. I'm with you. And I'm feeling. And now I'm going to cry. No, I'm blubbing in a theatre. You know, it's a magic thing. But yeah. Like you say, I mean, I've gone very niche in my musical as well. You know, it's a story of a stressed out dad who makes a wish for a day off and turns his family into mannequins. And that's the...
Love it.
So that kind of, that sense of fun that you were talking about is very much flowing through that. But again, that's not a commercial musical. The opening, you know, the first song is called like Stuck in a Life I Hate. And the chorus is, you must be fucking kidding me. Every bit of me needs a break. And it's like, okay, that's not going to be a commercial musical, is it?
No, but I already love it. And I'm going to have that stuck in my head all day now.
It's great. One of the other ones starts like, holy shit.
See, because I will say, my favourite thing in the world are weird little niche brand new musicals. I mean, Operation Mincemeat is like my go-to. I adore it, like, because I've been following that for years because it's written by band members that I like.
Okay.
And the fact that with a lot of these small shows, it takes so bloody long for a cast recording to happen. And I'm just there as someone who loves music and who, like, if I hear a song, I will remember the lyrics very, very quickly. So I will just be there with only my own head to keep me entertained. And it's so frustrating because I'm not going to be, you know, listening back and hearing those two little snippets you just sang, going, well, I can't see the show.
What is it? How is it? How does it
this
work?
This is awful. I hate
this. I'll send you a voice note. You can have an unofficial cast recording because they all exist, you know.
No, but I think you've hit the nail on the head there, because weirdly musical theatre, like, it doesn't really matter what's happening in the show or what the music sounds like, even, you know, because every genre, every style of music you can want is represented in musical theatre. It's that magic of being in the room and watching it happen. And you know, the going on the journey with the person and not only that, but like experiencing it in this like room of like-minded people is so, so special. I think it's one of the things that I kind of taken for granted when the pandemic happened, and then like my first time back in the theatre felt so special. And you know, I will say, benefit of wearing a mask in a theatre, people can't see you crying, you know, top tip there. But it's just magical, and you know, it's so lovely hearing someone like yourself speaking with such genuine passion and enthusiasm for it. And you know, it's why I love doing interviews like this, because you really feel like you get an insight from the people who know it and understand it, but who also genuinely love it. Like, you love it so much that you're willing to do this every day for as long as they will have you. and I think that's an incredible thing. And you know, I wish you all the best with it. And I really hope that musical comes to fruition so that the little weirdos like me can go and see.
I mean, at the very least, to be honest, if money was no object, I'd just make a cast recording. That's what I'd do. I'd go, let's just make a concept album. it tells a story. It's very clear, but they're great banging songs. So it could be an album, you know, and just make it. But I just need a spare like 10 grand, maybe. I don't know if anyone's, any listeners out there.
I'll do that. I was going to say, you know, when you go to the theatre with Waitress and they're like, oh, we've got the charity buckets at the end, you know, just for start.
Yeah, exactly. Put on a new musical. Put on a new musical.
I'll say it. You know, I suppose on that note, I probably should bring it back to Waitress, because I'm so pleased that the show's going well. And I'm genuinely really pleased that you're back in it now. And I'm so, so grateful for you chatting to me today, because
that's great.
You know, I've loved talking to you. And the last question that I have to ask you, obviously Waitress is going to be here in Nottingham. Why should we come and see it?
Oh, I don't think you should bother, really. So it's a bit of a drag.
Yeah, end of the show. There we go. Curtain down. Fine.
You should come for you should come because it's great. You know, it's a great bit of entertainment. There's it is that brilliant thing that commercial musical theatre is, which is like there's tears, there's laughter. You know, there's a load of fun in it. I get to have loads of fun. There's other characters, Ogie and Dawn, particularly, who get to have a load of fun. But it's also at the heart of it, a really you know, serious and dark sort of underbelly to the whole thing. It's a weird thing to marry those two up quite in the way we do, but we do it and do it very successfully. It's a really, I think what I love about it actually is that it's a really messy, all the characters are really messy. And she even says, you know, I'm messy but I'm kind in the song in She Used to Be Mine. All the characters are very messy. You know, here really at the heart of it for my character, you've got someone who we kind of like and root for, whilst he's kind of actively having an affair on his wife with a married woman who's also his patient. So everything morally he's doing is completely wrong. And yet we're going, go on, do it, you know. But it's messy. I think it's a real reflection on life of like these characters who are just bumbling along, trying their best and getting it wrong, trying to make it right, you know, fighting themselves or not or whatever it is. You can't help but, not to suggest that all our audiences are having affairs, but you can't help but see yourself reflected, I think, in these messy characters who are just bumbling along, trying their best in a difficult situation. And also you get banging songs, great voices, great performances, and potentially me going on as Jenna if they have a shortage of covers.
I mean, fingers crossed. I will be praying that on the press night in Nottingham, Elsie gets locked in a cupboard somewhere and they have no choice but...
Could happen.
I mean, One Man Waitress starring David Hunter. I think it writes itself.
I like creating stuff. Careful what you wish for.
I mean, I think we'd all pay plenty to see David Hunter in a one-man version of Waitress, right? Maybe we shouldn't be giving him ideas. A huge thanks to David Hunter for taking the time to chat to me and for making me all the more excited about going to see Waitress. As I said, it'll be here in Nottingham at the Royal Concert Hall from the 18th to the 23rd of July, and you can get tickets via the link in the post. I will also be reviewing it after the opening night, so make sure you check back here to see what I think of the show and to find out whether we did at long last get David's debut as Jenna. Fingers crossed. We'll wait and see. For now, though, I will say goodbye for this week. Of course, I will be back again before you know it next Sunday evening at 7 p.m. with a brand new spotlight on to let you know exactly what's going on in the world of musical theatre. You can also follow along on Facebook at URN Showtime and on Twitter at Showtime URN to make sure you never miss a moment. Because, as we say, the showtime must go on. Until then, good night.
You're listening to Showtime on URN.